Hello, welcome everyone. Hello and welcome. Welcome to the Alaska World Affairs Council. My name is Lisa Falsco. I'm the Executive Director. And such a pleasure to see so many people here on our first program of the Ambassadors Series. And if you like what you see today, we will have more. On the 20th of June, we'll be featuring President Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson from the Republic of Iceland. And the President will be speaking to us on the global crisis and the future of the North, lessons from Iceland. So please RSVP so we can make sure we have enough room for everyone to attend this special event. We are a membership organization, so if you are currently not a member, please take the time on your way out to become a member of the Alaska World Affairs Council. And by doing so, you help support our mission and programs and our students and allow us to have more such programs in the future. Can you hear me in the back okay, everyone?
No.
Is it possible to turn that up just a little bit louder? Super. And if you could also take a moment to turn off your cell phones. We do enjoy all of those cell phone ringtones. However, today's program will be recorded on KSKA. So if you could turn off your cell phones, that will be much appreciated by our radio listening audience. And thank you so much to William for doing the recording for KSKA. This program will be available on the KSKA website. If you'd like to listen to it at a future date, simply go to their website and look for AWAC Presents, and you will find this as well as some previous programs. Speaking of the microphone, during our Q&A period, if you could wait for the microphone as well to come to you, that will help our radio listeners and those here in the front. We do have today a wonderful bread basket from Great Harvest Bread Company for a raffle. If you haven't picked up a ticket, you probably have a few more minutes. You can go to the front desk and pick up a ticket for that. At this moment, I'd like to recognize students. If we have any students present today, if you wouldn't mind standing to be recognized, we appreciate you coming, students. Fantastic. Welcome. And thank you so much to BP for sponsoring the student lunches today and every day, as well as Nana and Shell, who are now offering free Alaska World Affairs Council memberships to all students. So students, please stop by the front desk and you can receive your one-year membership. Thanks to Nana and Shell. I would also like to recognize in our audience today, I don't see her right at the moment, but we have Acting Consul General Mary Gilbert from San Francisco. I think she, there she is in the back. Hello, welcome. As well as several people from our Consular Corps here in Alaska. It's such a great pleasure to see you. Please stand, Consular Corps members. Fabulous. Thank you for all your longtime support of the World Affairs Council. And now I'd like to introduce our head table. To my far left is Greg Wolf, the Executive Director of the World Trade Center of Alaska, our partner in this program today. We have partnered with him on several programs, and it's always such a pleasure to do things with the World Trade Center. Thank you for coming. And to his right is Consul from UK, of course, Diddy Hitchens, who will come to our podium and introduce our speaker. Thank you so much, Diddy.
There's just one person in the audience who wasn't introduced. I am very delighted having... Do I have a closer? Okay. There's just one person in the audience who wasn't introduced. I am delighted having the ambassador here to also have his wife, Lady Shimold, but she is in her own right, Dr. Julia Dunn, and I would like it if you would just rise to be recognized. I would like to thank Dr. Tom Nicewander at the Alaska Native Medical Center for putting on a program for Dr. Dunn to learn about how healthcare is delivered in rural Alaska. So thank you, Dr. Nicewander. It is a great pleasure for me to introduce Sir Nigel Sheinwald, Ambassador to the United States from the Court of St. James, in other words, from the United Kingdom. I'm delighted that he has been able to devote a full week to visiting Alaska and has been able to visit South Central, Sitka and Southeast, Southwest Alaska, and also the North Slope. So he, in a short while, has seen a great deal of Alaska. I was particularly delighted when he said that he would be willing to speak to the World Affairs Council as a past president of the World Council and deputy president of the board of the World Trade Center Alaska. Those two organizations play such an important role in making sure that those of us who live in this relatively remote part of Alaska can be, or of the world, can be kept up with what's going on internationally, politically, economically, and it's a marvelous thing that essentially virtually everybody who's interested in international affairs here in Alaska, either from a business perspective or just a general perspective, through those two organizations is kept in touch with the world. So thank you to the two organizations for hosting the lunch today. Sir Nigel Sheinwald is a career Foreign Service officer. He joined the Foreign and Commonwealth Office in 1976 at the age of 23, right after Balliol College, Oxford. Immediately, he was recognized as a rising star in the Foreign Office. He's held a wide variety of appointments and has held overseas positions for the British government in Moscow, in Brussels, as well as in Washington, D.C. Early in his career, he worked on UK relations with Japan and with Zimbabwe. Subsequently, he has served as Foreign and Commonwealth Office Press Secretary and Head of News, Deputy Head of Policy Planning, Head of the Political Section and Europe Director at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. He was the United Kingdom's Ambassador and Permanent Representative to the European Union from 2000 to 2003, Advisor to the British Prime Minister for Foreign Policy and Defence Affairs 2004-2007, and then appointed British Ambassador to the United States of America in October 2007. He's approaching the end of his term here, but wisely saved the best for last, coming now to Alaska. He is particularly happy to be addressing the Anchorage World Affairs Council today, because addressing the Anchorage Alaska World Affairs Council here in Anchorage means he didn't have to be up and catch an aeroplane before 6 o'clock in the morning or deal with the TSA at some ungodly hour this morning. Would you please join me in welcoming him to Alaska? So, Nigel.
Well, thank you very much, Didi, for that very kind introduction and for your continuing outstanding work as Britain's honorary consul here in Alaska. Thank you very much for that, and we hope that continues for many years to come, despite the early starts. And I'd also, like Didi, like to recognize the work of Mary Gilbert, our acting consul general based in San Francisco. People come to speeches given by British ambassadors with some preconceptions of what British ambassadors look like and sound like. There was the British ambassador, Lord John Marbury, in the West Wing, who always wore a white suit and had a big handkerchief coming out of his pocket and was a rather foppish sort of character. That's one version. There was a British television series with another earthier action man, British ambassador in Washington, that I rather admired a few years ago. And we had a woman ambassador on a television series, British ambassador to Dublin, who was more of the sort of caring, touchy-feely sort of ambassador. In real life, British ambassadors are known for, and British diplomats generally, for a certain pragmatism. And there's a story of one of my predecessors, actually, who arrived in Washington a few decades ago, near Christmas time. And one of the first things he was asked by his office was whether he would agree to a request for an interview with the Washington Post. And they wanted to interview him about what he wanted for Christmas. The ambassador was a bit worried about this because it sounded as though he was going to be asking for something, which he didn't really want to do in his first weeks in the job. But he did reluctantly agree to give the interview, and that went ahead. And the newspaper article appeared in the Washington Post a couple of days before Christmas, and the interviewer, the journalist, had asked a number of ambassadors the same question. And the final paragraph read something like this. It said that when asked the Soviet ambassador, because it was the Soviet period, the Soviet ambassador said that what he wanted for the next year was the triumph of peace and democratic socialism throughout the world. The French ambassador said that what he wanted for Christmas was a world full of freedom and equality and fraternity for the whole world. And the British ambassador said that if it wasn't too much trouble, he'd like a pair of carpet slippers and a small box of milk chocolates. Thank you very much to the World Affairs Council and to the World Trade Center of Alaska for hosting me today, and also to the World Affairs Council for the useful and enjoyable reception that was held on Wednesday evening. I and Julia are delighted to be here on Alaska on our first visit, and I'm delighted that I've had a chance to see something of this wonderful state, though I recognize we've done no more than scratch the surface. I've seen the mayor of Anchorage, lieutenant governor, and a number of state officials. I've seen the chancellor of the university and his predecessor, and I'll be seeing the governor after lunch. We've seen a very wide range of people working in a range of sectors, including, of course, the energy sector, and there'll be a great deal to follow up from the visit. Now, I visit Alaska as the latest in a long line of UK visitors, from Captain Cook's sighting of New Albion in 1778, Sir John Franklin's second Arctic expedition of 1825 and 1826, which took him down the Mackenzie River to the area of the Arctic coastal plain that we now know as Prudhoe Bay, the Hudson's Bay Company fort, which was established in 1847 at Fort Yukon. And I know that there'll be many more after me. Britons are, after all, the third largest nationality of the 1.7 million tourists who visit Alaska every year. Now, on my first day in Anchorage last weekend, I saw the statue of Captain Cook at Resolution Point. Another rather later statue of Captain Cook is actually situated in the national, in the grounds of the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich, where we live on the Thames in London. And the Naval Observatory at Greenwich is the location of the Greenwich Meridian, 0 degrees. That's the starting point for measuring navigation east and west. It was during Cook's Pacific voyages that he established the location of halfway around the world, 180 degrees east or west from Greenwich, the international dateline, with which you in Alaska are very familiar, because it passes through the Bering Strait between Alaska and the Russian Far East. So standing here, I'm literally halfway around the world from my home in London. And while your home and mine are separated by that hemisphere's distance, I want to say at the beginning that Alaska and the UK do have quite a lot in common. Indeed, I sense something of an affinity between the people of Britain and Alaska. We're both at the far northwest extremity of our continents. Britain, of course, is an island nation. Alaska, separated from the rest of the United States by nearly 1,000 miles, and from neighbouring Canada by the harshness of terrain and climate. Now, it would be wrong to exaggerate the comparison. Britain is well under half of Alaska's size, although with nearly 90 times the population. And the average temperature in the UK is 50 degrees Fahrenheit, compared with about 30 degrees here in Anchorage. But living on the edge does affect character. There's a resilience, even doggedness, to the British character, a willingness to stand up and be counted and fight for principle, and a rich tradition of contact with neighbours for trade, for cultural links, and for security. We in Britain know that we have to make our way in the world and look outwards, not inwards. We honour our history and our traditions and the diversity of our people, but we also look ahead and we look forward. And I suspect that many of these characteristics apply strongly here in Alaska. Now, the UK and US have long been steadfast allies, although not perhaps at the time that Captain Cook departed in 1776 for the voyage which took him to Alaska. But I'm struck that at key times in UK-US relations, Alaska has played an important, if not always widely recognised, role. It was, for instance, the purchase of Alaska by the United States which spurred the Confederation of Canada, still at that time part of the British Empire. And at the height of World War II, it was the Alaskan Islands which were occupied by the Japanese, the only US territory to be occupied. Throughout the Cold War, Alaska and Europe were both parts of the front line against possible Soviet aggression. And today, British and Alaska-based soldiers are fighting and sadly dying together in Afghanistan. And both of us have suffered tragic casualties only in recent days. Now, today I want to look forward to the issues which affect the UK, the US, and Alaska, and to a world where countries must look north as well as east and west. And I'm going to focus my remarks in three areas. First, I want to talk about the changes in the Arctic and the policy which the UK is taking on the issues which flow from the melting ice cap. Then I'll move on to energy and the importance to the UK of a diverse and secure energy mix and the role of Alaska in the US and UK's energy future. And lastly, I'll discuss the role of trade and investment between Alaska and the UK, the risk to those links through protectionism, and the case for further international trade liberalisation. And I'll be happy to take questions at the end of my remarks. Now, I'd like to start today by discussing the Arctic. We in Britain are not an Arctic state, but it is. We are an Arctic neighbour with commercial, political, environmental, meteorological and scientific interests in the region. The UK has been a recognised official state observer of the Arctic Council since its inception in 1996. Now, today, international attention has focused on the Arctic as a result of climate change. And this is no surprise, given that the Arctic is one of the regions most affected by rising temperatures and sea levels. No one can doubt that the Arctic ice cap is melting. In 2007, I'm told, the coverage of ice in the Arctic in September was less than 80% of what it was in the 1970s. And many, although not all, climate models predict that an iceless summer could come as early as 2030. These changes have consequences for a range of issues, including shipping, fisheries, the livelihoods of indigenous peoples, and the environment. Now, the planting of the Russian flag in 2007 at the bottom of the Arctic Ocean shows how quickly the Arctic and politics in the Arctic are changing. And these changes have led to renewed emphasis on the governance of the Arctic Ocean, and the UK has welcomed the commitment by the five Arctic coastal states in 2008 to abide by the principles of the UN Law of the Sea with regards to Arctic governance. The rapid loss of sea ice in the Arctic presages a big increase in shipping in the region, both regionally and in terms of new shipping lanes. And this has clear economic advantages, the development of ports in key northern locations, but equally poses potential environmental and safety risks. Only last year, there were a number of incidents with ships travelling through the Northwest Passage. Following the adoption of the Polar Shipping Guidelines in 2010, the International Maritime Organization is working to adopt a mandatory polar shipping code for vessels operating in ice-covered waters, and the UK is playing an active role in those discussions and other IMO initiatives. And we also welcome the signing at the last Arctic Council ministerial meeting last month of a new Arctic search and rescue agreement. Now, with all the changes that are taking place, it's right that the international community steps up its scientific commitment to the Arctic as well. The UK has a well-established research community working on the Arctic. In 2009, the UK agreed a memorandum of understanding with Canada to share access to Arctic bases and logistics to support scientific research and researchers. And this includes access to Canada's new High Arctic Research Centre at Cambridge Bay. The UK is keen to ensure that there is a strong follow-up to the International Polar Year, which has done much to renew focus on Arctic science. And last year, the UK announced a new $24 million Arctic research programme to understand better the rapid changes in the Arctic. The new UK Arctic Science Office, based in Cambridge, is also discussing other international collaborations, including with the American National Science Foundation. Now, I can't talk about the Arctic without talking about the UK's commitment to addressing climate change. It's the scientific evidence, and some of it is here in the Arctic, which has led the UK to be a leader in efforts to find an international agreement to tackle climate change. There's no denying that the outcome of the Copenhagen negotiations at the end of 2009 was disappointing. But the commitments that were made at that meeting, including the US pledge to reduce carbon emissions by 17% by 2020, were important ones, and we in the UK will continue to pursue a legally binding global agreement at the Durban meeting at the end of this year, and we'll work closely with the United States to do that. That said, we must also focus a great deal of effort on achieving domestic low-carbon objectives. Under our 2008 legislation, the Climate Change Act, we've pledged to reduce carbon emissions to 80% 1990 levels by 2050. And we're delivering this commitment with a range of policy tools, including carbon trading, which rewards the most efficient companies, regulation and incentives to encourage households and businesses to make energy savings, savings that will help them through these difficult economic times. It's not smart to delay these measures until the economy is stronger. The current volatility of prices at the pump is just one reminder that relying on traditional sources of energy alone is far riskier than investing in a cleaner and more diversified energy mix. And cleaner, energy-efficient growth can be strong growth. In the past 20 years in the UK, carbon emissions have fallen by around 20%, while the economy has grown by over 40%. Now, we're using carbon budgets to keep us on track towards these goals. The first three carbon budgets were set in 2009, and the fourth was set last month. It binds the government to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 50% by 2027. This is a first. No other country has emissions targets stretching into the next decade. And this carbon budget shows that our new coalition government has a commitment to be the greenest ever. We've introduced ambitious targets on energy efficiency in residential transport and the industrial sectors. And we've introduced new regulations to support the development and deployment of renewable energy in the UK. We have more offshore wind capacity than anywhere in the world. And offshore wind already provides 3% of our total electricity needs. And by 2020, that could rise to 30% of all electricity consumed in the UK. And that's generating new jobs in Britain as well. We assess that the global market value of low carbon and the environmental goods and services sector is worth around $5.2 trillion in the financial year 2008-09. And the UK's sector is already valued at $183 billion and provides almost 910,000 jobs. The transition to a lower carbon economy is reliant on the well-established extractive industries. Mining, and copper mining in particular, is helping to drive our move to low carbon technologies. Demand for copper for wind turbines is growing all the time, and its essential properties make it irreplaceable for energy efficiency and many renewable energy applications. Copper, rather like traditional minerals and fuels like oil and gas, is easy to take for granted and almost impossible to do without. The international firm Anglo-American, which is headquartered in London, is a 50% owner of the Pebble Limited Partnership. They've already invested well over $100 million in environmental surveys and studies for a potential major copper mine in Alaska, and I had the opportunity to visit that site to meet the project team and some of the local people and see the situation on the ground for myself earlier this week. The company's consultants have been working on what will probably be the most comprehensive scientific environmental baseline assessment of any part of Alaska, investing millions in the process. And if the various regulatory, environmental, engineering, and economic analyses underway conclude that the project can proceed, and it's certainly not for me to preempt those conclusions, then we can expect billions of dollars worth of investment to flow into Atlanta. At this stage, however, what is important is that the regulatory process designed to scrutinize environmental and social impacts is allowed to take its course and not be preempted by any quarter. The UK is committed to a low-carbon future that's also an energy-secure future. Our energy mix will have to contain fossil fuels as well as nuclear and renewable sources. Nor can we rely on just one country or region of the world to produce the energy that drives our economies. If an energy future is to be secure, it must also be affordable, and that means increasing the sources of supply, including for the international oil companies. It's their innovation and investment that are prolonging existing reservoirs, as well as harnessing new technologies to discover new reserves, often at great depths, into which they can tap. And the UK continues to invite energy companies to drill for oil and gas in the North Sea. Recent events have, of course, reminded us of the risks. But in the UK, we don't believe it's for the government to be the sole assessor of those risks. Indeed, we require industry to identify and manage the risks of their business and convince our regulators that they're doing so. We're determined to learn from last year's tragic accident in the Gulf of Mexico, and we're working closely with the US federal government to ensure that similar incidents don't recur. BP opened its first office in Alaska in 1959 and is one of the original developers of Prudhoe Bay, which after more than 32 years in production is still the largest oil field in North America. I visited the North Slope with BP yesterday. BP remains the largest oil and gas operator in the United States, employing 23,500 people in the United States, including 2,000 here in Alaska, with many more employed indirectly as consultants and service providers. And despite last year being extraordinarily difficult for the people and the ecosystems in the Gulf, I know that BP is committed to meeting all of its environmental and economic obligations fully. It's the only party to the Deepwater Horizon tragedy that's waived the $75 million statutory cap on claims brought under the Oil Pollution Act. And as of the end of last month, BP and the Gulf Coast Claims Facility have paid out more than $8 billion in claims to individuals, businesses and governments. And it was good to see BP and the federal government that they recently agreed a settlement over the Alaskan pipeline spill in 2006. Fully restoring its reputation in the US will take many years, but BP has been clear in its commitment to its US operations, to meeting all legitimate claims in the Gulf, and to reforming its corporate culture. Shell, too, has been a long-standing and successful Alaskan partner since it started to produce at the Cook Inlet in 1964. And you will, I'm sure, be aware that they've been trying to explore in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas for a number of years and hope that this year they'll gain regulatory certainty to allow exploration to proceed. The potential hydrocarbon reserves of the Arctic, perhaps as much as 25% of the world's remaining reserves, are therefore important to the UK, as well as to Alaska and the lower 48 states. And extracting those reserves, as you all know, will be difficult, and it will be important that it's done in a way that protects the marine and ecological balance of the area and the way of life of its inhabitants. Now, it's sometimes said that foreign companies don't share the same broader commitments as American companies. We don't agree with that. The British government is committed to the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development Guidelines, on multinational enterprises, which provide voluntary principles and standards for our companies, not just in areas like employment, industrial relations, and combating bribery, but on the environment as well. And those guidelines are clear that multinational companies should work within the laws and regulations of the countries in which they operate to protect the environment, public health, and safety. The guidelines expect companies to have effective systems in place for environmental management and to engage in proper and timely public consultation. So on that note, allow me to move to the wider trade and investment relationship between the US and UK. The European and American economies are more deeply integrated than those of any other regions. Within this, the UK-US commercial partnership alone is one of the most substantial in the world, totaling nearly $1 trillion in two-way investment. We remain each other's single largest investors, and around 1 million jobs in each country depend on the other's companies. UK affiliate jobs in the US are high-quality ones, pay is 30% more than the average US household income. At nearly $500 billion, the UK's stock of investment in this country is literally hundreds of times greater than China's investment in the United States. The value of our commercial relationship can be seen in every state in the Union, including, of course, right here in Alaska. We're your largest foreign employers. UK affiliates provide over 3,500 jobs here. That's nearly 30% of all the jobs created by foreign-controlled companies. Alaskan exports to the UK were $29 million last year, almost double from the year before. But that does not include the substantial over $100 million of British imports of Alaskan seafood every year. And we are, I'm told, your world number one importer of canned Alaskan salmon. Our trade and investment relationships remain strong and growing, but that depends on open markets and continuing to resist the dangers of protectionism. Trade, investment, and therefore jobs can only flourish if we keep our markets open and our regulations and standards aligned. Global free trade benefits consumers through lower prices and greater choice, and opens new export markets for our businesses, creating jobs at home. The UK, going back to its seafaring history, has naturally been one of the most vocal proponents of keeping global markets free and uninhibited. We, like you, have a large vested interest in doing so. A quarter of UK jobs are linked to overseas business, and over a quarter of UK GDP comes from exports. And in the US, exports of goods and services supported over 10 million jobs in 2008. Here in Alaska, nearly 8% of manufacturing jobs rely on exports, and nearly 350 companies exported from locations in Alaska in 2008. On a per capita level, Alaska ranks in the top 10 exporting states in the United States. And Alaska exported $4.2 billion worth of merchandise last year, a big increase from 2009, of which $1.8 billion was in seafood. So what would happen in the seafood area if, for example, Japan, this state's largest export market, suddenly closed its doors to Alaskan seafood? That wouldn't be welcome here, and it wouldn't be welcome internationally. American business leaders frequently remind me that only 5% of their potential customers are in the United States. The rest are abroad. Companies want access to those new markets. Businesses in the UK feel the same thing, even more so, given that only 1% of their potential customer base is in the UK. But imports are just as critical. You can't have an export strategy unless others are willing to import. Today's supply chains are global. Imports are part of the simple, elegant, organizing principle called the market economy that makes free trade work. We cannot try to make everything. Rather, we should focus on our strengths. And in recent years, there have been attempts in the US Congress to make both trade and investment more difficult. There was a lot of publicity about the Buy American provisions in the 2009 stimulus package, which continue to rear their head. But of equal concern to me are restrictions on the vehicles of trade and commerce, on shipping, for example. By now, you've already witnessed the effects of the Jones Act, a 90-year-old law which restricts cabotage, that is, the transport of goods or passengers between two points in the same country, to US-manned and US-owned vessels. Attempts to protect US domestic industries, consumers and workers can often have, though, exactly the opposite effect, in this case particularly for the Alaskan consumer. In the UK, we got rid of our cabotage restrictions in 1849. A 1988 GAO report, the latest available for this state, found that the Jones Act was then costing Alaskan families between $1,921 and $4,821 annually for increased prices paid on goods shipped from the continental United States. Given that that report is based on monetary values which are nearly 25 years old, I'm sure the latest figures would be even more sobering. But the Jones Act has wider effects. A recent article in the Financial Times described the decline of American containerized shipping, citing the Jones Act as the root cause. Although it was an American entrepreneur, Malcolm McLean, who invented the container shipping line industry in 1956, it's Europe and Asia that today are home to the top 10 largest container ship operators in the world. The two largest US-owned companies, Matson and Horizon Lines, rank 30th and 35th, respectively, on Alpha Liner's table of global lines. So the US container shipping fleet has an average age of 25 years compared to a global container ship average of just less than 10 years. So I think that shows that protectionism really doesn't pay. More recently in Congress, last year's proposed Consolidated Land, Energy and Aquatic Resources, or CLEAR Act, sought to require any vessel operating in the US's exclusive economic zone to be US-flagged and US-owned, and to have all offshore oil facilities built in the US for reasons of safety. Now, we, of course, agree that safety concerns have got to be paramount, but rules do need to be fair, proportionate, and realistic, and such measures would have severely damaged investment in the US and destroyed US jobs and livelihoods in the process. Fortunately, that bill didn't pass, but we've already seen similar legislation introduced this year. As an island nation reliant on trade and commerce for centuries, Britain is unsurprisingly among the most vocal champions of multilateralism and the World Trade Organization. A series of often unheralded world trade rounds in recent decades have progressively lowered tariffs around the globe, and the result in the last 18 years has been that global trade has roughly quadrupled, constantly outstripping growth. The UK continues to argue for the conclusion of the WTO's latest round, the Doha Development Round. It would be worth around $170 billion a year to the global economy and would add 393,000 net new jobs to the United States. But unfortunately, that round, that negotiation, is on life support at the moment. It needs new commitment from China, India, Brazil, the United States and others to revive it. But the WTO isn't just about Doha. More importantly, it's about its membership and trading in a multilateral rules-based system, levelling the playing field on tariff, subsidies and non-tariff barriers. And there's one major country that has yet to join, and that's Russia, the world's 11th largest economy and the largest economy outside the organisation at the moment. I'm not surprised that it's Alaska's sixth largest source of imports, yet it ranks 23rd as an export destination. So we support Russian accession to the WTO, provided the final and outstanding issues in the negotiations can be resolved, because we think it would have a positive impact on the global economies, on the global economy. But we also want it because it will make doing business with Russia easier, harmonising standards for goods and services, and eliminating investment barriers, improving the protection of intellectual property rights, and generally making the business environment more straightforward. Russian accession to the OECD would also help, but Russia would need to demonstrate progress in environmental regulation, in enforcing laws against bribery, in its investment rules, and in its corporate governance. Now, in conclusion, I have absolute confidence in the UK-US relationship for the future and the economic and commercial ties which bind us. I take pride in the affinity between Britain and this great state. Those on the northwest edge need to stick together. And I'm confident that Alaska has an important role to play in our future economic relationship, especially in the context of a changed and changing Arctic. The UK and British companies will continue to play an important role as the Arctic changes, working in a balanced and responsible way to ensure that our economic and energy interests are secured, but in a way which protects the environment and your treasured and ancient local traditions. Thank you very much.
Now the ambassador is agreed to take some questions, and Flip will come around with the microphone. If you could please wait for the microphone for your question.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. Yeah, thank you very much, Ambassador. Kind of curious, does Britain see very much utility in the northeast or northwest passages, and what do you see that coming in the future for trade?
I'm not sure we have very much direct presence, involvement, whatever. The days of the old British Navy that I was talking about before have long passed. But our interest is in the traditional virtues of free passage and open trade, and that principle will, you know, we support wherever in the world that's that's at risk. So I'm not sure where the security presence in the this part of the world and in Northeast Asia and so on that was the case centuries ago. But we're very, very much interested in the principle.
Yesterday, Mr. Ambassador, Secretary of Defense Gates, speaking in Europe, blasted European cooperation in NATO enterprises and suggested that perhaps the U.S. might be considering withdrawing its support. I know there's a valedictorian talk, so it's sort of his last shot. But I wonder whether you have any comments on the future of NATO and its relation with the United States and Great Britain.
Oh, there you are. I didn't see you there. I suppose it would be helpful for the for the questioners to say who they are. That would always be helpful. Let me respond. I mean, we share a lot of the frustration that that Secretary Gates expressed in his speech yesterday and has expressed before. It wasn't as though he was saying this for the first time. We're one of those NATO countries that that contributes a very great deal. We, after you, are the second contributors in Afghanistan. We have about 10,000 of our forces in Afghanistan. That's probably about three times as many as the next contributor after us. It doesn't match the scale of the American involvement, but it's very considerable. And our forces have been fighting since 2006 in the most dangerous part of Afghanistan in the south. In over Libya today, the NATO effort is being led by Britain and France, with American support. America is not in the lead in Libya at the moment. Diplomatically, in dealing with Syria, it's the UK and France that have put forward the resolution in the Security Council, which is being discussed at the moment. So we share a concern that NATO defence budgets have to be sustained in very, very difficult and austere fiscal times. We've got to be wise to that. The US defence budget is obviously contracting, as well as European NATO budgets. But speaking for the UK, we believe that NATO is a critical institution for our security. I believe that's widely shared in this country, despite the frustrations. For the UK, although we have to trim our defence budget, we will remain the fourth largest defence budget in the world, and our defence percentage will remain at or above the 2% of GDP target, which is the NATO target, and which actually only about six NATO countries actually follow. So we're with the United States in wanting to see a high level of commitment from our NATO partners. We have to do that knowing that the budget pressures are biting harder than they've ever done, working in a cooperative way, recognizing that, as in Libya, the United States is not in the lead on Libya, that some countries will not be able to do everything. Even the mighty United States has to take a back seat on that mission. Next one.
Maybe I can just talk about it. There's a significant difference in the approach of the UK government and the US government in dealing with the aftermath of the financial crisis. Yesterday, the Archbishop of Canterbury came out with a somewhat controversial approach. I wonder if you could comment on those differences between the U.S. and the U.K. dealing with it, and from your standpoint, why you see there are.
Sure. Did everyone hear the question? The question was why there were differences between the UK and US approaches on the response to the financial crisis, and he rightly referred to some internal criticism of our government within the UK. First, just to get on record, the fact that much of the immediate response to the crisis in 2008 was very much a shared international response. What we've all done, although there have been some differences, the broad lines of the response on reform of our financial services sectors, the recapitalization of the banks, the use of the group of 20 countries as the premier instrument of international financial coordination in the aftermath of the crisis, the measures that we've adopted to strengthen international coordination in those areas. That's all been very much a shared response in the crisis and beyond. And we're groping towards, these aren't easy, we're groping towards a much better macroeconomic coordination with China, with the emerging countries, so that we bring better balance into the world economic scene. But what you're talking about, I think, principally, is the issue of deficit reduction and the sort of fiscal side of the equation. And it's true there that our position in Europe maybe remains a little bit different from the position in the United States. Certainly when our government came into office in May of last year, we had the largest amount of debt in our history. And servicing it was a major problem. And there was a very big public mandate for dealing in a very determined way with debt and with our public deficit as the first plank of our new government's economic policy. And that's what we did. So we're going to get our budget deficit down from about 10% last year to 1% in 2015, in the lifetime of the current parliament. Now, we know that involves a risk, but our judgment was, given the size of the British economy, the pressures from the markets, the risk of contagion from Greece and the Eurozone economies, which have been struggling over the past year or so, that we didn't have the luxury of any alternative. We had to take these measures early on to re-establish our credibility with the markets and to re-establish the principle of sound public finances, and we've done that. And our credit rating AAA rating has been confirmed. And of course, there's a debate about the nature of the cuts and the severity of the programs, and that's going to be very painful in our country over a period of time. But the government's absolutely convinced that if we hadn't done that, we would have come under very, very significant pressure, particularly if you think about the Irish crisis, which followed the Greek crisis, the Irish crisis in the autumn of last year. What would it have been like for the UK if we hadn't undertaken this major program of deficit reduction? So that's why we did what we did. It's actually been strongly welcomed by the international community, by the IMF, welcomed by Tim Geithner, the US Treasury Secretary. And I'd just like to pause, without getting into your politics, on where things are here. Even, you know, here, things have moved. It's not as though in the United States the president or the other major party here, the Republican Party, is doing anything other than saying that there must be robust deficit reduction policies. There's a disagreement over the detail and over the how. But over the past year, and I'm not saying you're copying the UK, but over the past year, the fact is that deficit reduction has occupied a much more central position in American politics than it did a year or 2 years ago. And that's because the economic need for that to take place has increased. I don't think the American economy is under the same pressure as the smaller European economies have been. But nevertheless, that, you know, your ratings agencies have also issued a warning about what would happen if, in the medium term, there weren't greater certainty that the American deficit was being taken care of and was going to be reduced. And that, I don't want to go further into this because, obviously, I'm tiptoeing into very sensitive domestic territory. All I'd say is that this is a much more central issue here than a while ago. It's a central issue in Europe. We've gone further in Europe, but I think you'll find most of the European countries adopting, like us, austere measures, recognising this is going to take a few years to work out of our system, and hoping that that will help us to get back into growth and private sector-led growth over the next couple of years, and that's what we're trying to do. Got to attract the attention of the man with the microphone.
Well, that's fine. You can restate the question.
Okay.
Professor, thank you for coming here. You're excited. One question I had was, how do you think the recent fiscal changes in the UK are going to impact investment in North Sea exploration and production?
Well, I hope that they won't affect it. I mean, we rely still a great deal on a thriving North Sea sector. Here, there is a debate between our energy companies and the government on the level of tax, that's a debate, I guess, all around the world. But we took the position after the Deepwater Horizon tragedy a year and a bit ago that we weren't going to stop issuing licenses for the North Sea. We continue. We added a few additional precautions, but we've continued. And as you know, our model of regulation in the North Sea was one that was actually complemented in the recent Deepwater Horizon Commission report. So we feel we've got a very modern and credible framework for dealing with this. But of course, energy companies, like any other business, don't like being taxed, and that's a subject of lively debate between the government and our energy sector. The gentleman in yellow, I think.
Thank you. Quick question back to the fiscal responsibility that Britain has demonstrated. Did Britain partake of subprime lending to the degree that the U.S. did?
Here.
Did Britain partake of subprime lending to the degree that the U.S. did? I was amazed at the fiscal responsibility that showed.
The answer is there was quite a bit of that in the earlier part of this decade, and now not, I think, to the same extent as here, but some of the same lending practices and loose lending practices got into the system in the UK just as they were here, and that's been corrected in the UK just as it's in the process of being corrected here. So our housing prices didn't come down quite as much as they have here, and I think, you know, the housing sector continues to be difficult here, continues to be difficult in the UK. But something of the same thing happened in the UK as here.
We have time for one more question.
I'll ask one. On a less serious note, you know at least one good Winston Churchill joke?
Well, the one that everyone, it was a joke, is the famous saying that you can count on the Americans to do the right thing once they've exhausted all the alternatives.
We'd like to thank the ambassador for coming to Alaska. I know you've seen a little bit of our beautiful state, but we'd like to entice you to come back. So we have a book for you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And I see the breadbasket tickets coming this way. Don't worry, that's coming up. But before I do that, I'd also like to thank a couple more people. Diddy Hitchens, she is, like she mentioned, a past board member of the World Affairs Council and past president. Thank you for making this possible, Diddy. And Greg Wolf, also a past board member of the World Affairs Council. There's a lot of you out there. And Lady Scheinwald, thank you so much for letting us have your husband for an hour here. One more lucky winner, Kari. If you would bring up these tickets, we'll have the ambassador pick the winner.
All right. Okay. Shall I read it out?
Oh, you did much better than I did.
Okay. So the number is 583940. 583940. I hope it's not Diddy or Mary Gilbert.
There we go. Right here. Super ambassador.
Congratulations. Congratulations.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. And remember, June 20th, we will be featuring the president of Iceland. Please RSVP. Have a great afternoon.